From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello and welcome to the Log4 Podcast. I am Evan Ratliff. Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer are my co-hosts of the Longform Podcasts, and they're with me right now.
Aaron, you look well exercised.
I forgot we were doing an intro and was running in the field across the street from my house when I received the text message to come here.
I like the idea that it wasn't like a jog, like you just occasionally just run in fields.
Yeah, yep. Part of my podcast training regimen.
Evan, you occasionally do the interviews. Who did you talk to this week?
This week, my guest is Rosina Ali. She's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. She is a former staffer at the New Yorker. She's written a lot of great magazine stories over the past few years, including one that won the National Magazine Award last year. We talked a lot about this one. It was, you may remember it, it was about an Afghan child that a U.S. Marine attempted to adopt and then had removed from her family. It's an insane story. It really blew my mind when I read it. So we talked about that. Just the week before last, Rosina also had a story about the three Palestinian college students who were shot walking down the street in a town in Vermont.
I read that. I did not realize it was her. That story sucks.
Yeah, that's her. So she's written about the war on terror. She's written about Islamophobia. She's written about many other topics. We talked about those, and we talked about the whole kind of arc of her career so far. So it was a great conversation.
We're brought to you in partnership with Vox Media, who help us produce this show. Thanks to everyone over at Vox.
And now here's Evan with Rosina Ali.
Rosina, welcome to the Longform Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm very excited to talk to you. I want to start by learning a little bit about your career rather than jump straight into some stories. Because while I have read a lot of your work, I don't actually know that much about how you got into journalism. So I wanted to do one of those where I take you back and have you describe for me first, what do you remember about like when you first had an impulse to become a journalist or maybe just a writer? Do you have like a moment that you look back on as like that was a pivotal moment?
Yeah. Oh, that's such a good way of framing the question, because when people ask me, how did you get into this career? I actually never know how to answer that question. But I was very drawn to books, which is not a unique answer for a writer, but I was very drawn to books when I was young, and specifically writing. I loved writing short stories. And I remember watching TV, and I can't remember what it was that I watched, but someone on the show mentioned, I'm going to be a journalist. And I had watched news TV, but I never considered that you could be a journalist and a writer. And all of a sudden I was like, oh, that sounds great to me. I can write and I can have a job and I can travel the world. And that was kind of I don't know. That was, that seed was planted in my mind when I was about in middle school, I'd say. And since then, I mean, it wasn't a, I didn't think that I definitely was going to be a journalist, but it was on my top five career choices.
And you don't remember who the fictional journalist was? Be interesting to know.
It was a sitcom. That's the funny thing. It was some sort of bad family sitcom.
You probably would be happy that you're not having the career of whatever supposed journalist. Like the portrayals, they have ethical lapses that you don't find, or hopefully you don't find.
Oh yeah, totally.
Among your colleagues, like whenever you're the fictional journalist, but
also they made journalism look like, you know, your Carmen Sandiego back then, which had its own appeal, but that's not what journalism is. I found maybe it is for some people.
And when you started to approach it as you got older and thought, well, okay, that's what I want to get into. To what extent did you sort of look at it as an industry? Like, this is an industry I want to break into, as opposed to this is kind of like a craft that I want to develop? Because I think people come at it sort of from different directions.
Yeah. I will say, I will admit, I did not think about it as an industry or as a craft until very recently. In the last less than a decade, because essentially after college, I was just trying to find a way to make a living and how to combine that with some of my interests in international affairs and in writing and in editing. And so I basically just went wherever I could find a job, and that, you know, piqued my interest in some way. And at some point, I ended up moving to Cairo. This was a couple of years after the Arab Spring, and I moved there to become an editor at a small global affairs magazine. And that, I thought, was my first foray into journalism, proper journalism. And I did not know what the industry looked like in America. I really had no, I mean, I read, but not as a writer. And so when it was time for me to move back, I was thinking how I could possibly break into the industry. And a mentor who has become a friend suggested I apply for a job as a fact checker at the New Yorker magazine. And I was like, yes, a job. Again, something that combines my interests. And I did.
I want to talk about fact-checking in just a second, but back to the Cairo experience, what do you feel like you gleaned from, I mean, that's an interesting way into work for this, I don't know much about the Cairo Review of Global Affairs, so what were you sort of, what kind of perspective did it give you on sort of what it means to write about international affairs or report on international affairs?
Yeah. Well, you know, what was kind of amazing was that even though I was not reporting in Arabic, and I was actually, because I was an editor, I wasn't really doing a lot of reporting. I did some. But just being in that city, even when the discussions were about U.S. foreign policy, I really got a sense of just how differently people thought about the world and the U.S.'s place in the world. And it was not in any sort of particularly critical or hostile way. It was just a different way of conceiving of global affairs, and especially after the Arab Spring, after, you know, there's so much upheaval in the Middle East. Talking to people, talking to scholars, experts, you know, activists, just you get a real sense that America has a very particular way of thinking about what drives people politically. And it's something I wasn't really able to articulate to myself until maybe my second year there. You know, Egyptian society is shifting, we would probably have a very different language for it in the US. And I will say it was kind of refreshing not to be caught up in the American news cycle of it all for those 2 years.
I mean, I feel like that part of the reason I asked the question is I feel like some of your work later, it really is about how Americans have these impressions of the world that they project upon the world, which then just don't match up with how the world sees itself or even match up with reality. And I'm wondering how much of that was forged by being there versus that's a sort of perspective you came to naturally by being here.
Yeah, I mean, definitely it was something that I came to quite naturally, just the way I grew up. I mean, I grew up, you know, it's funny because I am often thought of as like a Muslim writer, or sometimes I am, and I hate that term, at least as a description for me, because I don't know what it really means. Yes, my family is Muslim, and that's been an identity marker, especially over the last 20 years for a lot of Muslim Americans. But really, the experiences that kind of forged my understanding of the world were being an immigrant in the U.S. and being from a poor family in the U.S. And I think those two things really made me question already the larger narrative of how Americans perceive America. Mm-hmm. And then after 9/11 happened and after the wars in the Middle East started, I just, you know, it was kind of it sounds like a simple and innocent question that I was raising, but really I couldn't figure out why the religion that I grew up in, the religion that brings so much solace to my parents, would be villainized in such a way, and also just kind of just pretty much misunderstood. And so I think from very early on, I just had this notion that I want to, it's not quite correct the narrative, but at least complicate it, somehow make it more complex or layered.
And where did you grow up?
In a very small town in the Central Valley in California.
Oh.
I hardly meet anyone who knows where my town is. And they're like, oh, yeah, I know, you mean Fresno. And I say, no, that's a big city compared to where I grew up.
Right. Ray, I spent 10 years in San Francisco, and I fear for you to say the name because I probably wouldn't even know how little time I spent out in the Central Valley.
Yeah, well, you might actually know it because if you've ever driven down the 5 or up the 5 between LA and San Francisco, you will see a lot of cows. And yes, 15 minutes away is the town I grew up in.
No, oh, what town is it?
Coalinga.
Oh, wait, is that the town you wrote the Nation story about?
Yes.
Oh, I don't think I knew from that story that you had grown up in that town.
Yeah, I thought I had mentioned it at one point. Maybe it was, yeah.
It might be in there. I just didn't remember that part of it. I love that story. That story was one of those be careful what you wish for kind of stories.
Yeah.
But so without losing the thread, so you come back to the States after you're in Egypt, and then you get this job as a fact checker at the New Yorker. Now, this is like almost like a more traditional path into journalism than you see a lot these days. This is the path that I also took. I was a fact checker.
Oh, and at the New Yorker?
At Wired.
It's always fun meeting fellow fact checkers, even former fact checkers, because I feel like we're part of this small world.
Yes.
That knows something that other people don't.
Yes, we have all had these experiences. Like every fact checker mine was a long time ago, but I can still remember, you know, the author who said like, don't worry about it, it's fine, you know, and then you track it down and you figure out that it is wrong. And you're correct. Just like, that's why I'm here. That's why I'm doing this. But it is kind of an endangered species, the magazine fact checker these days.
Yes.
But so when you got into, first of all, did you enjoy fact checking?
Oh my God, I loved it. I did not grow up reading magazines, did not grow up reading The New Yorker or The New York Times Magazine or Time or anything, because we just didn't have access to it. And this was my first time really being able to appreciate what goes into a magazine. And I tell this to everyone, fact-checking was probably the best education I could get in how to put together a magazine piece. And I loved it. I loved working with the writers and the editors. Didn't always love calling the sources, but it's kind of the client management, which I had done in a previous life. So yeah, it was kind of fun for me.
What client management work did you do?
So before Cairo, I was working for this group called the Economist Intelligence Unit. So we had to produce research reports for clients, which in my portfolio were mainly healthcare companies.
That's a valuable client management experience.
It was a very random time in my life.
But so when you're fact-checking, I feel like a lot of people have the experience. I mean, I certainly have this experience of you're seeing how these stories actually get made and, you know, the things that people mess up, the extra call that they don't want to make, that you have to make for them, all those sorts of things. But then you start to get an itch to say, well, maybe, you know, I could do this. But there's a kind of fine balance when you're inside a magazine of your ambition to do that versus maybe not wanting to seem like entitled that you know, and there's sort of like politics around when people on staff get to write the big stories. And I'm wondering how you navigated that and when you sort of felt like you got and how you got your opportunities from sort of within that.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't even think about it as a strategy, and maybe I should have. I mean, I just kind of thought of it as I'm going to write whenever I have something to say. And, you know, while I was in Cairo, I was doing some short pieces here and there for various places. I just thought I would become like some sort of columnist. The idea of becoming a full-fledged reporter didn't actually seem possible to me. And when I first started at The New Yorker as a fact checker, I mean, there were already things that I wanted to talk about, mostly about the war on terror. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I wrote short pieces about the TV show Homeland. I wrote this essay about the poet Rumi that I had been wanting to do for a long time. And these were things that I just pitched because I thought, oh, I just want to write about them. And then I want to say it was like about a year or a year and a half in, maybe a couple of years into the job, where I got this itch to do longer pieces myself. And then I had to really think about how to look for those pieces. That is something I didn't know, mm-hmm. is how to look for those big stories. And I think I didn't quite learn how to do that until I left The New Yorker. Mm. I left The New Yorker in order to pursue writing, but I was still learning how to be a magazine writer.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I still am.
Was there a story that you felt like, now I am doing what I envisioned that I would be doing. I'm doing this, the work that I thought I was capable of doing.
Yeah. I think it was my first story for the New York Times Magazine, which was about this case of a young Muslim immigrant guy who was convicted on terrorism charges and essentially sentenced to 30 years in jail. And that was the first time where I felt like I could just gather all my reporting and research and everything and my arguments and everything that just has kind of interested me about politics and about the world I'm seeing, and be able to put it together in a narrative, and to be able to actually do that and with all those elements and, you know, actually make it into a coherent narrative story. That was the first time where I was like, oh, yeah, okay, I know how to do this. I can do this.
That's the Herald Square bomber story, which, yes, I was actually reading, believe it or not, yesterday, and realized that I was sitting in Herald Square at one of those tables reading the story about the supposed Herald Square bomber. And that story, it's an amazing story. And how did you decide? Because there were many such cases, and you outline them in the story. You know, there are many cases where there are these terrorism plots and someone is arrested and then they usually end up taking a plea, but in this case he didn't. And it turns out that of the five guys that were involved, like three of them were actually informants, or in this case, one of them was an informant, you know. And how did you sort of settle in on, oh, there's enough here in this one that I can pitch it as a story and I can deliver it as a story?
Yeah. I did talk to a lot of people, like a lot of families. So the story idea started differently. And I didn't even actually have a story idea in mind. I was just curious about the families of some of these people who ended up in prison for terrorism charges. And I was like, oh, these seem to me cases of, you know, families being broken apart because of the state. And I just wanted to see how the family members were faring. And I met this guy's mother, and I spoke to several families, but this mother was just so talkative, and I speak Urdu, as does she, and so we just spoke in Urdu, and she was telling me all this stuff. And there was one detail that she told me that struck me, which was that their family is Ismaili Muslims, which is that Ismaili Muslims are a very small sect of Shia Islam. And it just so happens that my family also is Ismaili, and I was like, this is unusual to hear of a terrorism case where the perpetrator is Ismaili. Mm. It's just, I've not heard of them. And that's when I really started digging into this case. And the more I learned about it, the more I thought, oh, there's something off here. And I think it was just the access and my own interest being piqued by this one particular detail that made me want to pursue it as the story.
There's this element of the story where, and again, I feel like I've seen this in some of your other pieces as well. It's like how the legal system gets manipulated in the service of this particular ideology, basically, which is there's all this danger out there and there are these dangerous Muslims and we need to like go into the mosque and send informants in. And then the prosecution creates more, like it actually serves as evidence that there is a problem because look, we've successfully prosecuted one. So the system just kind of like cycles on itself. And I guess my question there is, how do you go about sort of writing at two levels in terms of the story, this individual story, and trying to capture the larger theme that the story is about? Because this was an old story. It wasn't like, I mean, he'd been in prison. So, yeah. You know, it wasn't like there was some fresh news where he was about to get out or something like that.
Yeah. So normally I find that, you know, one of the great things about magazine writing is that it actually allows me to investigate someone's life. And I find that a lot of coverage of terrorism cases, including this one, just kind of stop. You know, their only frame of reference is the actual case or the actual trial. And I'm always curious about what happens before and what happens after. And so I really just try to elongate that frame.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like the first level I was working at. But then that second level of what you're talking about, you know, that analysis of what's going on more broadly in the legal system or politically, what's the context? I'm thinking about that all the time as I'm reporting and writing. You know, I have my own, I want to say hypotheses, but those ideas get really clarified as I'm reporting. And, you know, one thing I do is I actually sometimes will just have a piece of paper or like a Word document or whatever I'm using and just write out all the big top level, big picture ideas that I've come to. Not all of them make it onto the page or in the article, but it just helps me frame what are the big themes that I'm thinking of here that are emerging here. And mm-hmm. also sometimes when I'm writing such a long piece, I just kind of need to have one big sentence on top and bold to tell me what is this piece really about.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the other one that was in there that really struck me in the current context was this notion of, well, they use these informants against this guy and many other guys, but also watch out because when this gets applied to domestic terrorism, so-called right-wing terrorism, you're going to see the same thing happen. And like you see this all the time with whether January 6th or the Michigan plot against the Michigan governor, where now all of these right-wing people are up in arms about this exact same issue. But what you wrote struck me as sort of unusually ideologically consistent in that you were saying there's a principle here and this principle is being violated and watch out because this principle is going to be violated against you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's always been a concern to me because I could see just growing up in the shadow of 9/11, just how civil liberties had been discarded. And I will say this is not a thought I had come to on my own. I mean, this is something I had been discussing with lawyers and activists and just people who had been affected by it. And everyone who could see the long arc of history, who could recognize what happened before 9/11, they could tell where this would head. And I wanted us to really think about what it meant to put people in jail. And, you know, I made it a point not to make it seem as if this guy was completely innocent. He did say some of the things he said, but I was questioning whether he deserved 30 years in jail. and I wanted Americans to question that too. And I think it's important because even though this is a case that's already happened and he's in jail, right, and he wasn't released after this piece came out, these policies are going to affect wider circles of people. So how do we think about these policies? How do we think about putting people in jail for decades on end for something as, you know, frankly, mm-hmm. as little as saying something violent or saying something nefarious? You know, the thing about power is that once you get power, it's really hard to give it up. So I wanted Americans to really think about what happens when we allow the government so much power to take away our civil liberties in the name of national security.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wise just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
Fox Creative.
This is advertiser content from 26.2 Team Milk and their new docuseries, Running Sucks.
Is running the worst?
Yeah.
Do you love it? Do you hate it?
I hate it so much. I hate it so freaking much.
That you're a real runner now!
I hate it.
I'm Abby Ayers, a 37-year-old mom from Utah who found herself running across the Manhattan Bridge in my first race ever.
Running Sucks celebrates women who run and the running communities that carry them across the finish line.
Running helped me in so many ways postpartum.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
For every person like you, I'm telling you, you belong, and I'm telling you, you can do it.
I never thought the words would leave my mouth, but yes, I'm planning on running a marathon. I can't even say it without laughing, because, like, who would have thought?
Watch Running Sucks at runningsucktheseries.com and learn more about how Team Milk is helping women runners across the country conquer their next course.
I don't know if it was before or after that you wrote this nation story about, I guess, your hometown in California and its decision to encourage marijuana, the legal marijuana industry to set up shop there as a way to save the town. But it's quite a different story. And you've done a series of sort of stories that are focused either on the war on terrorism or you know, international type stories. This is a different type of story, which just makes me wonder, sort of, how do you decide? It's easy to get sort of one type of story that you do that people ask you for, and then they want it over and over. And that one was so different. And even though it's about a serious subject, I thought it was quite fun in a way. How do you decide how to find, you mentioned finding ideas, like what guides you?
Yeah. Well, so that was my first ever magazine story. And it has a, you know, special place in my heart. I honestly go towards stories that pique my interest and that pique my curiosity, and that especially those that seem not to be what they are. Everyone, when I heard about this marijuana plant coming into Coalinga, my parents had left years before this happened. Everyone, I just kind of saw like news stories saying, this is wonderful for Coalinga. This is going to be an economic boom. And I was thinking, well, I remember when the movie theater shut down, and I remember when all these, you know, when the Kmart shut down. And I guess it can be good, but I remember them promising this when the prison, the state prison opened up, and when the mental hospital opened up. And yet still we had people leaving the town. So I was skeptical already with this like economic success story. But what really interested me too is that this is quite a conservative town. And I was like, how did the city council allow a marijuana plant in this town where the open, you know, when you drive into the town, this, the big sign you see is Jesus is the Lord of Coalinga. Like none of it made sense to me. And so that's when I just started making some phone calls and like went back to the town and started talking to people, because I wanted to know, well, what's really happening here?
Well, it's a real roller coaster, because the guy convinces everyone, okay, to set aside your morality questions. And like for the first half of the story, he's done it. He's brought in the money. He did it. And then suddenly that industry starts to lose its value for the town, and they have to lower the fees and everything. And it felt like, oh no, now it's slipping into this disaster.
Yeah. Yeah. Which it's terrible. I mean, I shouldn't laugh. It is terrible, but you know, let's just say it has not been an economic boom for Coalinga.
That's too bad. So speaking of story ideas and where you find them, so you did the story about this adoption case. And I mean, if you could find a story that more encapsulates like the war in Afghanistan in one story, I don't know what it would be. It really is kind of like, if you want to know what happened with the US and war in Afghanistan, like you could start by reading this story and it'll tell you a lot. And anytime I like explain to someone the story, they're like, what happened? Wait, hold on. So first, maybe you could tell a little bit of the story just so people have some context that they haven't read it, although they should. And then I want to talk about like how you came onto this and decided you wanted to pursue it.
Yeah. So in a nutshell, if it's possible, this story is about this this baby girl who was orphaned in Afghanistan because of a U.S. and Afghan raid, night raid. And she was taken to Bagram Air Force outside of Kabul. And essentially what happened was that the Americans were treating her because she had injuries. She was just an infant. And meanwhile, the Afghan government was looking for her relatives. And eventually they found them, and she went on to live with her relatives in Afghanistan. At the same time, this U.S. Marine who had seen her decided to file for adoption, even though she had not ever stepped foot in America. But he and his wife were able to get an adoption order for her. And essentially what happens over the next few years is he befriends this baby's relatives, convinces them to come to the U.S. and takes custody of this child. And then there is a legal battle between this U.S. Marine and the Afghan relatives of who is the rightful guardian of this child, a case I am sad to say is still ongoing.
Yeah, I looked it up. I think anyone who read it now would go and look it up. And unbelievably, the case is still ongoing.
Yeah, it's been a shock to me, actually, that it's been going on as long as it has.
When you started speaking to them, I mean, what kind of state were they in? Because I mean, certainly when it first happened, I mean, in the story, they don't know what's going on. Like, they don't know that this couple has secretly pursued an adoption of the child that they are taking care of that is their relative. And so it's just difficult for me to imagine the moment when that became clear and the child was taken away from them. But then when you were speaking to them, what kind of like emotional state were you finding them, and like how did you deal with that in terms of interviewing them?
So I think when I first talked to them, this was maybe, I want to say like 7 months after they found out what had happened, and a few months after the Does, who I call the Does, the Afghan relatives, after they had filed a lawsuit or at least brought some legal claims against the U.S. Marine. So they were kind of in the middle of this legal case, and they didn't really want to talk to a journalist. They wanted it to be private. They were really nervous for various reasons. And when I first talked to them, I did not have my notepad in hand. I was not recording. I just talked to them off the record, and I just wanted to get a sense of how they were doing and why they did not want to talk to a journalist. And I think it's very, very important to speak to people as people. To speak to sources, even if you have the juiciest story, to really give them the grace that I think everyone deserves, especially people who are going through such a difficult time. And I was actually very hesitant to tell my editor about this story because I knew he would be excited, but I didn't want to do it until I knew I could get them. And I actually gave myself the very real possibility that they would not agree to talk to me. And I would say, okay, fine, and walk away. As hard as it was, I did not want to pursue this story without their consent. And, it took a couple of conversations. It took a couple of Zoom conversations. I went out and met them in person. And, it was hard for them. They were, as gracious as they were towards me, they were in a terrible state. They had just lost their daughter. They were worried sick. They had just come to America. They're trying to find their way around, trying to make a living in this country. Their family in Afghanistan didn't know what was happening, so they didn't even have emotional support. So there was a lot going on. And I wanted them to feel like they could feel all those things, that I wasn't going to be at their doorstep pushing them to talk to me. And I think they appreciated that.
To the extent you can say, what do you feel like it was that actually allowed them to have that trust? Like, I think a certain person would go in and say, well, this will help your case, or, try to give them an outcome-based approach, which can be true, but also can end up not true. So what do you think it was in your approach that maybe allowed them to speak with you?
Yeah. So there were two main things. Like, one was they were extremely worried about their identity coming out or identity being revealed. And I made it very clear to them that I would do whatever possible to protect their identity and their names. And really the only people who needed to know their actual identity would be me and the editor and the fact checker. Just, three people at times, and that was it. And I made it a point to say how I was changing their names. I just went through the steps with them. But the second thing, which I really don't feel too comfortable talking about, but, because I don't want to betray their confidence, but they explained to me why they were worried about their identity being revealed. And I heard that, and actually, I felt like I could strike a personal tone. There was something that had happened in my life that I could relate to them, which I was able to. And I think that helped build some trust because I felt like I could tell them, I kind of know where you're coming from here.
I see. So there's also this family on the other side of the story, and they did not speak to you. And the thing that's striking in the story as a reader is there's so many moments, for me at least, I'll just speak for myself, where I just think, like, this is so fucked up. Like, someone has got to stop this. And like, it continues on, but there's also this undercurrent of like, the other family feels they feel righteous. Like they feel, as far as anyone can tell, they're not like purely nefarious. Like they haven't been going around the world stealing babies for some nefarious reason. Like they believe they have a righteous purpose and what they're doing is actually better for the child, or at least that is what they are saying. And there's not that much reason not to believe them. So how did you approach like knowing that, like that's to me, that's what makes the story so extraordinary.
Yeah. I appreciate you saying that. You know, like one of the things that really interests me about anything I cover is this big question of why do people do the things they do? I really don't just want to assume people's motivations because of who they are or what they said. I'm really curious to understand what compels someone to take such extraordinary measures. And with him, I really wanted to give him and his wife their due, you know, in the sense of I wanted them to be able to have some voice in the piece, even if they weren't talking to me. And I did try. I texted and emailed and called. I'm sure they were sick of me, but I did it like every week for several months. But I think because I didn't get that, it was actually even more important to me to really dissect the text messages they were sending, their WhatsApp calls with the does, you know, their email exchanges with officials, because I really just wanted to understand what is it? What is it that really compels you? And actually, for background research, because after I learned that they're, you know, quite devout evangelical Christians, I read this like big book on evangelicism because I decided I don't actually understand evangelical Christianity that well, and I want to learn the history of it. And let me just at least start there. And you know, can't say that it directly went into the piece, but at least it gave me some understanding of a world that I was not familiar with.
And part of that, from their perspective, is the sort of good intentions that they have. And I feel like it projects out on the whole U.S. in Afghanistan endeavor, these sort of like having good intentions. But are they good intentions if you sort of ignore all of the signs that the actions that you're taking are not helping the people that you claim to be?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Like they're still good intentions, but you've blinded yourself. But I wondered the extent to which that was in your mind as this is sort of a larger story about why the U.S. did the things that it did.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it could not be not on my mind. Is that right? Yeah. but it was just hanging over me the entire time, because when I was writing it, the withdrawal from Afghanistan had happened the year before. I mean, it was, pardon my language, it was such a shit show. But I had been following Afghanistan for many, many years now and could see this complete unraveling of a conflict. And there was this myth in the American narrative that we had propped up this wonderful government in Afghanistan, but it really wasn't. And as someone who had been following just how Afghanistan was falling apart, I was constantly, every day I was writing, I was thinking about the larger implications. Like, what does this one story tell us about what the U.S. was doing in Afghanistan over the last 20 years? What their good intentions ultimately turn out to be, and the havoc it wreaked upon families, you know, millions of families. And I felt that weight in particular because of the Afghanistan withdrawal. And, you know, as I was mentioning earlier, I usually have this like Word document that I put down all my themes. Mm-hmm. As I was writing this story, I mean, I would just, every single day, I would just have this scrap, you know, I would like note on a scrap piece of paper some thought that I had about what does this mean about Afghanistan and the U.S. and the war on terror, and just these like ideas were just kind of like going, just shooting off into my mind. And funny enough, it was one of the easiest stories for me to write because I think so much of it was just in my mind for months and months.
There's a sort of last element of the story where you track down some of the people in Afghanistan about that are surrounding this question, family members. And I felt like reading it, like you probably could have done the story without that? Like, they would have published that story. So what was it that drove you to take it that extra step?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to do it because, well, one, because I'm a reporter and I just, I had this itch that I needed to scratch. but the second thing is that I wanted to acknowledge that whatever the failings of the Afghan government, it still ostensibly had some autonomy, and it still had some, it was still governing this nation at that time. And I wanted to explain just what that meant. You know, they were doing their job, and what did their job doing their job mm-hmm. look like? And then the other element in Afghanistan that I explored was the actual night raid and the aftermath of that
right.
and what the villagers found. And the reason I decided to pursue that level of reporting is because I actually wanted to give the U.S. Marine the benefit of the doubt, because his argument was, actually, this child's parents, this orphan's parents, were terrorists, and therefore I have every right to her. And so I wanted to say, okay, putting aside all the ways in which you decided to adopt this child, let's take you at your word and explore this question of who we consider a terrorist. Like, were they actually terrorists? And that became important to me because there's, you know, that word is thrown out around so much, especially in the U.S. when you want to accuse someone of something, if you don't like them, they're a terrorist. And terrorists do exist, but I think that scope, that word has kind of lost meaning because we assign it to so many people. And I wanted to just wrestle with that term and with that accusation a bit in the piece.
You also did the story for The New Yorker about the sort of collapse of this women's organization in Afghanistan. And I don't know if you did, if that was all one reporting trip or you did multiple reporting trips, but I had a practical question about reporting in Afghanistan at this time and sort of how difficult that is and how you approach that.
Yeah. So there were different time periods where I was reporting. So the Afghan women, although I was writing them simultaneously, now that I think about it, I didn't sleep for those months. the Afghan women's piece, the reporting I was doing was in Kabul. And I want to say the Taliban had, by that point, had been in power for 8 months by that point. And at that time, yes, they had been, they were definitely getting more strict, you know, all the dress code I could sense was changing. And it was, it's one of those places where, you know, everything is fine until it isn't. Like, you just, really reporting isn't that hard because you sit in your car, you go meet the people you want to meet, you have a conversation, you have the interviews, and it was fine. You know, ultimately, I think it was more dangerous for the women who talked to me than it was mm-hmm. for me. And I think about mm-hmm. that a lot. I mean, at one point, they all came to the hotel I was staying at to do these interviews with me. Because we all decided that would be the safest and most efficient. But later I wondered if it actually was that safe for them because there were the Taliban Secret Service kind of out manning the hotel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were observing who comes in and out. And I was like, okay, these women are kind of on their radar. And then the next time I talked to them, I had gone to the shelter to speak, and it was in this remote part of Kabul. And yet, even then, I was thinking, oh, if anyone is around, like if a plainclothes Talib is around, they could see that I'm, you know, this foreign journalist is walking into this house. So I'm constantly aware of the danger, not necessarily to myself, but to the people who are talking to me. And that makes me nervous.
So I want to bring it kind of up to the present time because you had a story in just recent New York Times Magazine. And I wanted to kind of talk about that in tandem with the profile of Rashida Tlaib that you did, you know, a couple of years ago, because in some ways that I feel like that gave you a real perfect kind of background for this moment, having done that story. So looking back, let's look at that first. At that time, so that was 2022. What were you trying to do in that piece at that time?
I'm not sure. No, I knew why I had pitched it, but I'm not sure if the piece ended up doing what I wanted it to do. But I was really, really interested in not necessarily looking at Rashida Tlaib as like the first Palestinian American congresswoman. You know, I don't love firsts. I just don't. But I was more interested in looking at her being a Palestinian congresswoman in a Congress that is pretty heavily pro-Israel, while at the same time fighting for progressive policies at home, which are gaining more traction in such a Congress. And I felt like that was the tension that really was going to come to the fore in the Democratic Party. And I thought that she would be the perfect person to distill that tension and really channel that and kind of explore that tension through. So that's why I had pitched the piece. And funny enough, we are seeing that tension now, right? It's like, how does the Democratic Party deal with the progressives who are, you know, progressive domestically, but not necessarily on Israel-Palestine? What do you do with that? And yeah, and you're right. It did kind of, it was a good, what did you call it? It was a good background for this moment.
Yeah. Well, it really struck me that part of what it's about is, as you say, it's like she's reckoning with, I mean, she's pursuing these policies that are actually just progressive policies. They don't have anything to do with her identity as a Palestinian American. And yet, like, that gets pulled into it all the time. And now suddenly that it's that, you know, times a thousand with the war. It's like that is always front and center and sort of like how her, but real business still has to be done that's outside of that.
Yeah, exactly. I actually don't know, honestly, if Israel and Palestine were a peaceful place, I don't know how much she would talk about the fact that she's Palestinian, right? Like, that identity is important to her because of the way that Israel-Palestine is, because of U.S. foreign policy in the region, because there is so much conflict. Like, that, then that identity becomes a bit more crystallized and perhaps in her mind necessary to emphasize. But I mean, she told me many times, well, not many times because we only spoke twice, really. But both times, you know, she told me that she wishes she could just focus on Detroit and Dearborn. She wishes she could just focus on where she lives and domestic policy, but she's thrust into a world where that's not possible.
I mean, there are echoes of that in this story of the three Palestinian college students who shockingly were shot in Vermont, and they have sort of, they're just college kids, you know, and they are like involved in causes and things like that, but they also, it's this sort of like their identity. We don't know exactly why they were shot, I guess, at this point, but like their identity sort of overwhelms what they would like to be doing to a certain extent.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think there's this, maybe it's because I know at the beginning I said I hate being called a Muslim American writer, but I'm going to say it now as an example.
It's up to you. It's your choice.
Well, I reject it except for right now when I say that. I understand why that identity becomes important to emphasize. We know when something is under threat, you want to say, no, this is, I am this too, and it's okay to be this. And I think those three college students sadly live in a world where they cannot not be Palestinian. Like, they have to be. And that is, you know, the reason I wrote the piece as I did was because I did not want to assume that they're proudly Palestinian because that's where they grew up. I actually wanted to understand how and why did they get to a place in their life where they were walking down the streets of Vermont wearing keffiyehs. That's really the question that I was after. And through that, I just got a larger sense of how they grew up, how they thought of themselves in the world, and then thought of themselves as Palestinians in the world. And I think it's just, you know, I when I went into the story, I really did not know what it was going to be, especially because that case had been covered by every major news outlet. And I was just thinking, yeah, I mean, it was. And I was like, what am I possibly bringing in? And I will say, I made it so complicated. I was like, oh, I can talk about the history of hate crimes. And I can talk about, like, you know, this. And I did do all the reporting for that. And my editor, God bless him, was like, that's not interesting. Like, that's not interesting for this piece. Like, let's really hone in on these three students. And I realized the ultimate story was just them. Of the what it means to be people and what it means to be Palestinians, and you know, it's tragic. It's tragic that we live in a world where sometimes I think it's tragic that sometimes we live in a world where identity has to be amplified in such a way because it's under constant threat, and we can't just be college students, or we just can't be boys, or we just can't be whatever we want.
Yeah, I think you've answered it, but I wanted to ask you about the choice of starting it where you did, because you start with them, like how they grew up and how they became friends. And it's really just a story of friendship and how a friendship gets maintained over time for much of the story, where you could have started with the shooting.
Yeah. And I did, like, the first draft was, I had this, like, really, you know, in your head, like, very elaborate scene. And it was just, it was about the shooting. And again, God bless my editor. He got back to me. He said, you know, everyone knows this. And I said, yeah, you're right. And my instinct was no, but do they know this detail? And, you know, and it took me a day, and I was like, yeah, he's right. And I think that what really captured people, at least captured me, was the fact that, one, they were young men, but before they were young men, they were boys. And there's this, again, you know, it's all related to stuff I've been thinking about for years. But I have grown up in a world and have done journalism in a world when young men are very quickly, especially young Muslim or Arab men, are very quickly perceived to be terrorists or dangerous. And I wanted to understand, one, why they were not considered as such, but two, well, What were they before they were young men? Like, well, how were they as boys and how were they as friends? And, you know, terrorists or, like, dangerous men or, you know, whoever perceived to be dangerous don't just pop up out of nowhere. People all have their life trajectory. And that's what really resonated with me in this case.
And as a writer for the New York Times Magazine, you know, the magazine kind of sits over here a little bit in the papers, like this behemoth. But the paper is in the middle of a constant 24-hour firestorm about how it is covering the war and all the issues around the war. And how much is that in your head as a reporter for the New York Times Magazine, who you're not in the middle of the daily coverage, obviously, but when you went to write this story, it's on the issue, but do you try to disengage with that? Do you try to be aware of all of it? Where do you sort of, how do you sit with that when you're trying to be a reporter for the New York Times?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, as I'm saying this out loud, I think this is actually the case. I'm obviously informed about what's going on. I read the criticism. I understand what the issues are. But I really disengage. And it's not necessarily an active or deliberate decision, but almost it feels like it doesn't concern me, because when I'm a magazine writer, I really admire news writers, but that's just not the kind of writing and reporting I want to do. But also, I really feel like I try my best to serve the story, whatever that may be. And sometimes that means having it out with my editor on certain issues. But at the end of the day, I really just try to focus on what best serves the story. And so I really tend to mute out, you know, whatever issues there might be. I don't really pay attention to where this is going. I'm just really a little laser focused on the piece of writing itself. So far that served me well. Who knows? Maybe I should be a bit more more considerate to the fact of that it's published in the Times. But I don't know. I really, really appreciate my editor at the Times. I really appreciate that I could just talk to him about things that concern me. And at the end of the day, if the story is able to say what I wanted to say, I think I can be proud of that.
Yeah, I mean, another way to kind of get at it is like the newspaper story is like there's this whole discussion about objectivity in journalism that's been going on for years. But the magazine stories, in my view at least, are already allowed to be inflected with your ideas and your viewpoints and your conclusions about the story. They are woven into the story. They have to be defended. It has to be fair. There are all these aspects to it. But I think people who are just like, New York Times, New York Times, would wonder, do you feel like you have to hold back on ideas that you have? Or even do you have the impulse that like someone would probably like me to hold back, but I'm not going to, in terms of outlooks that you have that somehow would disturb editors at the New York Times?
Yeah. I'm laughing because, yes, this is something I have thought of. The way I tend to do it is I feel like my editor and I have this understanding where, at least in the first draft, I could say what I want to say. And he will tell me what I can't. But a lot of times I'm actually quite restrained. I wonder why that is. I think a lot of the reasons I'm restrained is because I want the story to do the telling. And if I can't, you know, make my point without the story, then it's not a point worth keeping in. And otherwise, it just ends up being an op-ed piece, and that's not what I want to do. So, I really just try to balance that. You know, not to say that my editor and I haven't had conversations about some things, but ultimately, we always come to an understanding, and I appreciate that. Yeah,
the editing to you, those sort of like, well, let's tone this back. Does it always reads to you as editing, not as censorship? I think people outside that can read as censorship, whereas to us magazine writers, that is just part of the process that we engage with on any story about any topic all the time.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I wonder, oh, is this about censorship? In which case, if I really wonder, then I will ask. I will actually ask, well, why do you want to cut this? Explain to me your logic. And then we'll have a conversation. But most of the times, you know, I find that editors know what they're doing. And I hate to say this, but a lot of times when they've cut something I've written, they've been right. There have been a couple of times where I have had conversations about things they wanted to cut. And I really fought to keep it in because I thought it was important. And I don't regret those.
So one more aspect of this, you have written a story. You wrote this story for The Drift, this essay for The Drift, that was about the way the Times had covered ISIS. And It's a very thoughtful story. I thought it was a wonderfully written essay, kind of exploring both just how the media in general approached ISIS, but through the lens of, you know, the podcast Caliphate and what happened around that podcast. And it did make me wonder, as then, I don't know if you were already a Times contributor at that point or becoming a New York Times Magazine contributor. Is that something where it was sort of like, let's pretend this didn't happen? Or even that they were sort of like, actually, your thoughtful criticism is part of why we want you to be a writer for the New York Times Magazine.
Well, I wrote that piece before. Oh, yeah. I wrote that piece before becoming a contributing writer. But I think I wrote it after my first piece came out, or around the same time, after my first piece for the magazine came out. So I actually don't know how the editors thought about it. I don't know if they read it. They've never mentioned it to me. And personally, fine with that.
I'm not trying to out you here. It's on the web. People can find it on their own. It's not.
I mean, I'm not shy about it, certainly. And I'm happy. I'm actually happy to talk to them about it if they want, because I do think that we should be able to. I don't know why there's such a reluctance to criticize each other as journalists. I want a journalist to tell me if they think I have gotten a story completely wrong, and not in a way to like be hostile, but really in the service of improving journalism more broadly. And I don't mean this in like a preachy idealistic type of way. I do think that journalism is hard. And, you know, I actually don't believe in objectivity. I don't. I think we all come with our biases. Also, we all have different apertures for the way we look at the world. And journalism requires resisting those biases by doing a lot of legwork, by doing a lot of reporting and research and interviews. And I think that it actually serves us all when we question each other, when we question those biases or question like, why have you decided to report something out this way or talk to this expert? And are you coming to these conclusions based on assumptions, or are you coming to these conclusions based on rigorous reporting? And whatever the topic, whatever the conflict, I think that's just necessary to think through. And maybe that's why I just end up doing a lot of extra reporting. I get very obsessive because I'm mindful of the fact that we are all fallible, you know? So I just want to make sure that if I present something to the world, that I've done my due diligence.
I know you're writing a book about Islamophobia in America, and I'm first sort of wondering, in this moment, has either the Israeli-Palestine war, like the sort of like uproar in the United States around it, has that changed? Is this have you had to adjust what you're doing, what your plans are, or is it actually you're looking at something deeper that this just skims across the surface?
Yeah, it hasn't changed my plans in so far as it has made me reconsider how I'm going to end the book. Mm. It's such an interesting moment because it has both affirmed a lot of the things that I had been reporting on and researching for this book anyway. But it's also been a very shocking moment in the sense that I've never seen or even read about this level of dehumanization before. Mm-hmm. And there's a type of rampant Islamophobia that I see that I can't quite compare to other times, even after 9/11 or even after the Muslim ban by Donald Trump. And so I'm still actually trying to wrap my head around what to do with that, and where that leaves me, and where I should take that in the book, and what it says about our society. I want to be hopeful, and I'm trying to have hope about what comes next. But it's a bleak time, and I don't quite know what to do with that right now.
And how do you view with your work going forward, like in this moment, what do you think this kind of work can do? Like, is one of the ideas to try to find some hope, or if there's no hope, to expose the fact that there is currently not a lot of hope? What do you feel like you're aiming for, both not just in the book reporting, but also in the types of stories like this story that you just did?
Yeah, I've actually asked myself that very same question a lot in the last 5 months. And people have asked me that question too, very explicitly. And I think the answer I've come to is that it's really not changed from why I went into journalism in the first place. I really want to complicate the dominant narrative of war, of conflict abroad, of, you know, Arabs or Muslims in the US, and of anything really. And I think that's even more important to do now, especially because I find that it's harder to kind of disagree with the dominant narrative. Mm. I find it even more important to find a way to make things layered and complex and challenge what we just assume to be true.
Well, thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
That's it for this week's Long Form Podcast. My thanks to Rosina Ali for coming on the show. It was great to talk to her. This show was edited by Jackie Sajiko. Our show notes were by Megan Valley. My co-hosts are Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer. We do the show in partnership with Vox. I'm Evan Ratliff. Thank you for listening. We will see you next week.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Cult Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.